Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 79, and we're going to be talking about an individual again. This is another one of those podcasts where we choose one person and just sort of deep dive their life and times. Andrew, we've chosen a good topic for this one. John Zachary DeLorean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's we've said before, haven't we? We want the subjects of these people podcasts to have led interesting lives, and it helps if they're not saints, if they... You know, if they've been involved in controversies and whatnot. And, yeah, I mean, in those regards, John Zachary DeLorean is a perfect candidate, isn't he?
Yeah, no shortage of controversy with him. Exactly right. You know, I guess there'd be all sorts of people who just lived sort of glowing, saintly lives. But, you know, we're not going to go after, you know, villains or anything specifically. But, you know, I mean, people who have just, you know, who have... I mean, DeLorean, as we'll get to, was both those things, wasn't he? He was a hero and he was a villain. And, you know, his impact on the motoring world, I mean, everybody thinks of DeLorean, they just think of, you know, Back to the Future and the two seats and everything. But in fact, as I'm sure we'll get into, his history in America before all that was extraordinary. He's a fascinating, whatever you think of him. And I think it's probably important at this stage to get in really, really early that he was never convicted of any crime.
which
is actually quite extraordinary in the circumstances. But, you know, so we have to couch it in all of that, even though he is obviously long gone. He's just a fascinating character. So looking forward to get into it.
I mean, before we do get stuck in, we're recording this on the Monday after Rally Finland. And I just want to say congratulations to Elfyn Evans and Scott Martin for winning Rally Finland. It used to be, not too long ago, that if you weren't Finnish, or at least Nordic, you didn't win Rally Finland. Yeah. And it's really changed in the last decade or so. And so to win that event is a staggering achievement. And also a huge well done to Craig Breen and Paul Nagel in third. They were clipping along all weekend. Breen, they're not doing a full season. They're part-timers. And Breen described them, they're both Irish, he said, not bad for a couple of part-time paddies. And so, you know, to sit out a couple of rounds and step into a car, particularly for a rally like Finland, and be as quick as they were, bloody hell.
I saw some clips that have been sort of posted. I haven't said I watched it, but my goodness. You wrote something saying we really are in a golden age of rallying. And it honestly, I mean, you know, I come from the school that nothing's too fast, but it looks terrifyingly fast, doesn't it?
It's worth saying... Because, I mean, if somebody gets it a little bit wrong at those speeds, it's It's an airplane crash, isn't it? And
yeah, no small accidents.
No. Thankfully, that didn't happen this time around. It was spectacular to watch. So, yeah, I mean, we know that the cars are going to be different next year. And Malcolm Wilson told us, didn't he, the boss of M Sport, that he thinks they will be quicker, but they'll be heavier and they'll have less aero. I suspect on a rally like Finland, they won't be as quick, but maybe in a tight, twisty one where the extra hybrid power comes into effect, perhaps they will be quicker. Yeah. I don't know.
But I mean, we've also discussed, haven't we, that it's going to favour the thinkers, isn't it? It's not going to favour the freehand artists. It's not going to favour the, you know, the just chuck it in and sort it out merchants. It'll be interesting to see. But, you know, what we do know in all of motor racing is that, you know, any new set of rules rarely survives the first engagement with the engineers in the form that was originally intended. And whatever the organisers want the new rules to be, you know, people will always be thinking ways around them, and you know, I'm sure that if they start off as fast as the current cars, very shortly they'll become a lot faster, which is a bit scary, but it'll certainly not be dull, will it?
Well, no, and we know the new cars are safer as well. When you look at the roll, I've ridden in the Puma, and even just getting in the thing is really tough because there's a huge new roll cage bar, sort of. Right next to where you sit, and it, you know, loops all the way across the car, and you do feel pretty safe in there, except that it would be quite tricky to get out in the event of a crash. But yeah, I mean, how fast these cars are going now, it's obviously no bad thing if they're safer. So anyway, I just wanted to say congratulations to all of those guys because it was just superb to watch all weekend. But we're here to talk about John. We have to say John Z. DeLorean, don't we? We have to get that right. Born January 6, 1925, importantly, in Detroit, Motor City. I mean, that must have been the thing that really formed him, wasn't it? Being born in Motor City, it's to some degree inevitable that you end up in the car industry, as he did.
Particularly then,
you know, yeah.
So his formative years would have been, you know, just after the war. And, you know, in the 50s, predominantly, that's when he kind of made his mark. When Motor City was, you know, just probably the most exciting place to be on the planet in terms of the global car industry.
Mm, can you imagine? I suppose it was Silicon Valley in the 1950s, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably.
All that innovation, all that investment, lots going on. And so he went to university, then he did a post-grad course at the Chrysler Institute of Engineering, graduated in 1952. So, yeah, an amazing time, actually, only 7 years after the end of the Second World War. And he went straight into Chrysler's engineering team. And he was clearly a very bright prospect from day one. He was an engineer through and through, a proper engineer. I think that, do you know what? That actually gets lost, doesn't it? It wasn't until I watched something fairly recently that I realised he was an engineer. He wasn't a showman or a salesman or...
No, or a crooked businessman. I mean, no. He probably was all of the above, but originally, you know, he started off designing transmissions, didn't he? And he revolutionised... whose was it? Was it Chrysler's? Yeah, I can't remember. I mean, there was some transmission that he just kind of looked at and said, well, we shouldn't do this. We're going to make this thing really, really, you know, massively improve it in a very short period of time. So, yeah, pure engineer through and through. And in fact, in later life, he used to lament the fact that the sort of the engineer to bean counter ratio had changed so much in favour of the bean counters. And he thought the motor industry would be a far better place if there were just more engineers in it, which is hard to argue with.
It really is. I mean, his career went off like a rocket. So after only a year in industry, he got poached by Packard. And just an interesting stat that kind of demonstrates the high regard he was held in. He was paid $14,000 a year. Okay, which in 1952 is the equivalent today of 135 grand. It's a big six-figure salary after a year in industry. 4 years later, he was head of R&D at Packard, only 32 years old. So his early career just went poof like that, stellar. And he was in demand, evidently. Packard was struggling, so he received a call from General Motors offering him his choice of job in any five divisions at GM.
Briefly going back to the Packard thing, I think what is quite interesting is that Packard was kind of very much an outlier, particularly by then. And their business case was, you know, whereas obviously the big three would knock out cars on a sort of, you know, stack them high, sell them cheap basis, Packard was the opposite of that. They did really, really high quality engineering-led cars. And I think that probably informed a lot of DeLorean's thinking going forward. And he's always trying to do that. He's always trying to make better cars. And when he decided to go off and do his own thing, it's not surprising to me that he decided to go and build a, you know, a low-volume, high-quality sports car. Now, obviously, we'll get on to the quality issues with the DeLorean. It didn't quite work out that way. But, you know, that's certainly what he was planning. So I think his formative years at Packard, he went to Studebaker as well, didn't he? Although they merged, didn't they? I think, you know, I think you can understand a lot about the way he was in later life by the influences he had in his early working life.
Mm. And then one of the first things that he did when he went to GM, and he took up a post at Pontiac, where he was assistant chief engineer. Now, Pontiac, it was perhaps an odd choice because at the time, I think it was a deeply unsexy brand, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It really wasn't the kind of car mark that if you love cars.
But he soon changed that, didn't he?
He soon changed that. And one of, if not the first things that he did, and he was responsible for this, the Pontiac GTO, a proper,
yeah,
you know, copper-bottomed icon of a car. And he dreamt it up.
Yeah.
I mean, this is in the 60s in Detroit when the muscle car thing was just getting going, I suppose. But he was right there, ground floor, and he came up with the Pontiac GTO. I had no clue. So a lot of my research for this was actually just watching something on, I think it's on Netflix, Framing John DeLorean with Alec Baldwin. It's a bit sort of hammy in parts, but it's part documentary, part drama. But it gives you a real insight into who the bloke was and what he achieved in his early days, namely the GTO.
Yeah, I mean, amazing that still such a young person could have that much influence at that higher level in an organisation like GM. And yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, he was one of the founding fathers of the American muscle cars. I mean, we think of obviously the Mustangs and, you know, Chevy Camaros and that sort of thing. But the Pontiac GTO was, I mean, it was the boss, wasn't it? And he was ballsy enough to use those three letters, wasn't he? Which came straight from Ferrari. And he was ballsy enough to go, you know, this is how you should be thinking about this car. It's that kind of distance above anything, everything else. And briefly, it was.
Mm. Lofty ambitions, if nothing else.
Love to drive. Never driven one. I haven't driven that many proper American muscle cars. Which is probably why we've never done a podcast on one, because I don't really feel that qualified to talk about them. You know, I've driven Mustangs and Camaros and Chargers, so the really, really obvious ones. But something like a Plymouth Superbird or something like that, I just don't know enough about them, haven't driven them, but maybe we should. Anyway.
Maybe we should, and the GTO's on that list, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
The point being that he went into this very uncool car company, did something cool like the GTO, met massive resistance from within the company. That this isn't what Pontiac stands for, but it was a huge success, and it was really transformative for Pontiac. And you know, his star at GM was just in the ascendancy after that. I mean, there are some interesting stats around how. Well, okay, so we'll come to that a little bit later. But at the age of 40. He'd been given Pontiac. He was the head of Pontiac, and the youngest ever division head at General Motors, just 40 years old. And he was starting to become that rarest of things, which is the celebrity car engineer or car executive. He was prominent in high society. He was dating models and actresses, married a couple, hanging out with celebrities. Not your typical car company exec. There are lots of shots of him with, you know, an open shirt and sideburns and a tan. And he was just living that celebrity lifestyle.
He was the kind of the prototype for guys like Bob Lutz and Lee Iacocca and that sort of thing, yeah. Wasn't he? He was, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, when at a time when this is Motor City, when it's really roaring, it's, you know, swinging 60s. And if you're the boss of one of those car companies, you're held in the highest esteem, aren't you? And so quite soon after, before the end of the 60s, he's the head of Chevrolet. And he's earning mega money now. Yeah, I mean, maybe we have to take these numbers with a pinch of salt. I think they've come from his book, so perhaps not. But his annual salary in 1969 was equivalent to $1.4 million, with bonuses up to another $2.8 million.
I heard that. I mean, I always thought it was, you know, he was earning over, in modern terms, over $2 million a year.
Mm.
Yeah.
Staggering money, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. But, you know, there are no shortage of people in those sorts of businesses today who come on similar salaries. But I think, and again, you know, because we're obviously warming up to, you know, what happened to him, you know, what ended his career. I think that the culture, A, the personality that he was, but also the culture of the organisation that he was in, you know, he must have got to a point where he thought he could do no wrong. And, you know, I think he just thought that he was the man with the Midas touch. And I think that, and probably because the culture was, is that there was no one there turning around and saying no to him. And I think he could do whatever he liked, because most of the stuff that he'd tried to do had worked. You know, he'd been very good, hadn't he, with streamlining Chevrolet, getting the production costs down and making the company profitable and everything.
Turned it
around. So, yeah, he turned it around. So, you know, at that stage, you kind of think, well, there's nothing I can't do.
Mm. Yeah, you probably buy into your own sort of media persona, don't you?
You believe your own bullshit, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, it happens.
Mm. Yeah, well, so by 1971, Chevrolet, it had been in trouble, but by 1971, under his tenure, it was experiencing record sales. So an exceptionally gifted auto executive, he really was. A brilliant engineer and an excellent executive as well. And it seemed as though he was on his way to the presidency of General Motors. I suspect a lot of people thought it was inevitable. But in April 1973, he took a left turn and quit. Some say he was fired because the GM board saw him as a maverick, maybe a liability. But, I mean, I suppose we'll never know the exact circumstances. But in early 73, he left. And he was given a Cadillac franchise in Florida by GM as a retirement gift. Which is a nice way to depart, isn't it? And so having left General Motors in the same year, he founded the DeLorean Motor Company, which is, of course, is, I suppose, what he's best known for, isn't it? His name's on the car. Now, I sort of struggle to understand what this car was all about. Do you have a sense of where it was supposed to slot into the market? Was it a 911 rival? Was it a bit cheaper?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Well, it was certainly meant to be cheaper than 911. But I think that was it. It was meant to be, you know, a 911 for the everyman. You know, it was meant to be, you know, affordable. I think the 12, because it became the DMC 12, I think the 12 was the, in dollars, the intended price for it. It was going to cost $12,000. And I think that's what he thought he could do. I think he thought he could do an American 911 for a fraction of the price of the real thing. But as we know, it didn't work out like that. And you know, I was looking through the number of different power plants that car was meant to have had. It's extraordinary. It's meant to be a Wankel engine car. It's meant to have a rotary engine in it originally. and then it was going to be a Ford, wasn't it?
Right, okay.
It was going to have the Cologne V6 in it. And then, or was it the Citroen? No, maybe it went rotary Citroen. It was going to have the powertrain from a Citroen CX, 2-litre four-cylinder. And I think you then realised that wasn't going to do it. No, I think the Ford did come first. But anyway, so it went rotary Ford, then Citroen. And it's only after that that when they realised that the Citroen was, you know, the car wasn't going to be able to get out of its own way, given how little power it would have had, that they went to the PRV engine, the Peugeot Renault Volvo engine, the 2.7 litre V6 Duvrin engine, as it's known, which is when it was discovered that it was too big to be mounted as a mid-engine car. So they had to completely redesign the car to be a rear-engine car. I mean, yeah, that's just the I mean, it does surprise me that a bloke like DeLorean, who seemed to have such a firm grip and such clear ideas, you know, got all this really pretty basic stuff wrong. And maybe he was a victim of circumstance. I don't know enough about, you know, how things actually worked at the time. But he just seems to have not had a grasp on reality, which does surprise me. But, you know, we know that the car, when it finally turned up, was nothing like the car he originally envisaged.
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. If in the 70s you would have backed anyone to found a new sports car company and make a success of it, it probably would have been John DeLorean, wouldn't it? Because because of his everything he'd achieved in Detroit over the years. It was in the mid-70s that the prototype, the concept, I suppose, was first shown, designed by Giugiaro, with the gullwing doors and the stainless steel body panels. So immediately it looked completely unlike anything else on the road. A two-seater. Yeah, it was originally going to be a mid-engine car, but as you've explained, it went through so many different powertrains that eventually it was in the back. Now, was it quite as... I've looked at a few sort of technical drawings. Was it quite as rear-engined as a 911, or was the engine sort of over the rear axle line rather than right behind it?
Yeah, it wasn't as rear-engined as the 911, but you know it is absolutely correct to describe it as rear-engined rather than mid-engined. And you know, and underneath, it wasn't just that the engine moved; the entire way the car was built, because he wanted it to be have sort of glass fiber underpinnings and underbody. And it just wouldn't work. And that's how Colin Chapman got involved. That's how Lotus got involved. And, you know, when it was quite clear that they were never going to be able to put the car into production in the form that it was in, they went to Lotus and Colin Chapman went, well, we can fix this. And they did it by, underneath the underbody, having another chassis, which was basically the backbone chassis out of, well, it was related to the backbone chassis that was in the Lotus Esprit. Which fixed the car in that it could work and be productionized, but it also made it massively heavier than it was originally envisaged. So, yeah, I mean, so many mistakes made, so many false dawns, so much time spent, so much weight added, so much money spent. It's perhaps not a great surprise that when the car was finally unveiled, it was, a bit of a mishmash.
Yeah, quite different to the car he originally envisaged, I imagine. So it's just over 1,200 kilos, 130 horsepower, 153 pound-feet of torque. So we're not talking strong numbers, are we? It wasn't brisk.
I can't say, just over 1,200 kilos, that doesn't sound like much these days. I mean, back then, a 911, which would have been, the early 80s, a 911 SC, which had two more seats, would have been 1,100.
And 200 so it's horsepower. Actually,
yeah, with 200 horsepower. Well, or even back then, 1980. So in 1980, the SC came with 180, 188, or 204 horsepower. So it's probably the middle one. It's probably about 188. But just a completely different level of performance.
Mm. Yeah. So it was going to be a really quite technically interesting car, built in a very innovative way. But they couldn't do it, and so Lotus came on board and made it a more conventional sort of car, but something that they could put into production. And it did take, from the company being founded to the car entering production, it did take 8 years. And with all those different powertrains, different chassis configurations and so on, you can just imagine DeLorean becoming increasingly frustrated and wound up with all these delays, all these technical difficulties. So it must have been a relief when, at long last, it did go into production. And remarkably enough, it went into production in Dunmerry, just outside Belfast in Northern Ireland. Production started in late 1980. But they started building the factory in Belfast in the late 70s, which is... the troubles in full swing, I suppose, when they started building the factory. Actually an extraordinary time and place to try and build a new car plant. But the point was that the British government was offering huge grants to any companies coming into that part of the country and creating jobs.
I mean, there was massive unemployment there. There was obviously terrible sectarian violence going on there. And the Labour government of the late 1970s, I think, thought that this was a way to help with those problems, to bring some genuine prosperity. You probably got the numbers in front of you, but it was, I mean, in modern times, I mean, if you translated the figures forward, I mean, it would have probably been, I don't know, $500 million or something. It was 100 million or so, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Because, you know, they didn't just, because he'd tried to go to other places, hadn't he? He'd gone to Puerto Rico, I think. He'd gone to Ireland, not Northern Ireland, and they'd just gone, forget it. But yeah, the Brits said, yeah, bring it on. And they built a factory, they built a test track, they did the whole thing, didn't they?
Yeah, huge investment. And probably on the back of his name and his achievements over in Detroit. I mean,
yeah, but you'd think somebody would have had, you know, if you'd been around back then and you'd been shown this car and you knew its gestation, and you looked at the spec and you looked at the opposition, and you knew also that, you know, that people tend to buy, particularly with cars like, you know, mid or rear engine coupes, tend to buy on the badge, and that, you know, DeLorean may have been, you know, a long time before, you know, a big name in America. But I mean, you would have thought, is this worth betting the farm on? But it appears that nobody did, and they just went, here you go, here's the money, fill your boots.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, this is where the DeLorean story starts to become very murky. So in the early 80s, finally, this car is being built in Northern Ireland for the USA market. But in the early 80s in the USA, recession was looming. And so the market had become a much tougher place than it had been just a few years earlier. And it all meant all the complications, all the delays, the trickier market. I mean, you're right, they were intending to sell this thing for $12,000, but when it eventually went on sale, it had a base price of $25,000. So it just got out of control very quickly, didn't it? So selling a much more expensive car into a weaker market, a car that was nothing like the one it originally should have been, built in a factory that's never built anything before because it was new, with a workforce who
weren't... By people who'd never built a car before.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and there were huge quality issues.
Massive.
Given all of that, there was just no hope, was there, of this thing surviving and the company prospering from that moment on, it doesn't seem.
But also, you know, he made, you know, a bad situation much worse because, you know, when he would have realised that, you know, the car didn't get the press reception that he'd hoped it would get, unsurprisingly. I mean, this was a car, it's not 60 time. I think Road and Track or Car and Driver, one of those tested it. It was like 10 and a half seconds to 60, which even 40 years ago was, you know, so a 911 SC in the same era, six dead. Yeah, I mean, just a totally different, you know, there would be any number of, you know, sedans in America which would be quicker than that. A top speed, I think, of 109. It wasn't pedestrian performance. It was pathetic performance. So that coupled with, you know, the recession, when DeLorean realised that, you know, things weren't going well, instead of thinking, all right, okay, fine, we've got to cut our cloth accordingly and, you know, decimating production and just, you know, living within its means, he increased production, which led to those photographs of hundreds of DeLoreans, unsold, unwanted, just stacked up. It was just so sad. And it particularly sad for the people, you know, the locals, who must have just thought that their saviour had arrived, and had, you know, gone over there, you know, done their absolute best to build these cars, and just seen all their hopes and dreams just, you know, run like sand through their hands. It's a terribly, terribly, you know, people sort of think about it in terms of, you know, the financial fraud and everything else, which they should. But I was on some, I was looking at some forum the other day, which described what DeLorean did and all the consequences of victimless crime, because it was just money and it was government money and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, no, No, you think of the jobs and the livelihoods of the people who were there, and their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations. And because of the hubris of this bloke, and because he thought he could do no wrong, and, you know, frankly, all the dodgy dealing that went on, it all just, you know, turned to shit, frankly.
Yeah, it does speak to someone who had some enormous triumphs early in his career, bought into his own hype, thought he could do no wrong, and took at what looks like a bold or arrogant or egotistical, I don't know what it is, but decision to double production at a time when they couldn't sell cars. It's hard to know what the logic ever was. And so very quickly, the company's on its knees. John DeLorean is desperate. And that's how he gets caught up in a cocaine trafficking trial. He's desperate for cash. He needs cash to try and save his company. And somebody comes to him with what appears to be a very, very shady deal, offering to make a huge amount of money available to him if only he gets involved in a cocaine trafficking deal. And he goes along with it. There's footage of him agreeing. He's on board and he's, you know, he knows what he's signing up for, or at least he thinks he does, because in fact it's a government sting. It's the FBI coming after him, trying to nick him. It's an amazing thing, actually, and if you want to know more about it, you should watch Framing John DeLorean. All the footage is in there, the actual footage and the audio recordings of all of this going down. He knew what he was getting involved with. He was well up for smuggling some cocaine across a border. It just didn't turn out that way because it was a sting. And it was a huge story, wasn't it? Do you remember this all kicking off? I mean, you were several years away from starting in the car industry, but you, I wonder if you recall
it. Was. I mean, do I remember it? Yes, I remember it, but I wasn't because I was never a sort of news reporter. And in fact, I wouldn't have even been in the industry then. It was just kind of like I was peripherally aware of it. But what I do know is that the FBI, they completely stuffed it up. You know, they would have known better than anybody what the rules of entrapment were and what you can and cannot do. And DeLorean was able to provide the total defence of, well, you set me up. And if you do that, then, you know, a prosecution can't proceed. So he was acquitted, despite the fact that, as you rightly say, there's no question at all that he agreed to doing this extremely illegal thing in the eyes of the US law. And because of the way the FBI approached it, he got away with it, you know, and he was completely acquitted of all of all charges, which, you know, if you go and see what he had agreed to, seems remarkable, but, you know, they were idiots, and you know, the law is the law, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the way the law works. That's the way the courts work. So it's August 1984 that he was acquitted, but by then DeLorean Motor Company was bankrupt. And his reputation as a businessman was tarnished for good. I mean, wow, what a fall from grace that is. He was the star of the Detroit car manufacturing scene. He had the bravery to go off and do something on his own, and it just unraveled in no time at all until he found himself in a cocaine trafficking trial. But it wasn't the only enormous controversy. It wasn't the only trial that he found himself implicated in, because there was a fraud trial, a tax evasion trial. I mean, lots of that. Now you might have to let me know about this, but was it the government money that a chunk of went missing?
Yeah, I mean, so this was money which was meant to have been paid to Lotus for the development of the car, and it was paid through a Swiss holding company. This is just my memory of it, which may be faulty, but I think it was paid through a Swiss holding company and then just never turned up. And the accusation was that the money, in fact, was diverted through some other strange financial mechanism, company, offshore, whatever, to three people, to Lotus's accountant, Fred Bushell, to John DeLorean himself, and none other than Colin Chapman. I think the thing was, is, well, another thing that DeLorean got wrong was he'd obviously, you know, he'd built his factory and done everything else, you know, on the back of money that was provided by a Labour government in the late 1970s wishing to see redevelopment of that area, and I think probably didn't do sufficient due diligence to make sure that was actually a good idea. By the time all this kicks off, there's a Thatcher government in power, which is probably thinking an awful lot harder about, you know, whether money is being well spent and where it's going. And I think he thought, well, you know, the British government had always just taken his word for stuff in the past and that they would do it in the future. And they didn't. They hunted him down. Now, by this stage, he was back in America and they couldn't extradite him. So he never stood charges for that. Colin Chapman died, so he never stood charged for anything. And Fred Bushell went to prison for 3 years. And I knew of Fred Bushell. I don't think I ever met him. But I was very much in the industry then, and I can remember going to prison. And I can remember at the time, the view was that, A, he was banged to rights, but no more so, and probably less so than the other people who were involved, and that he was, you know, wasn't the fall guy for him because he was definitely guilty. I mean, he pleaded guilty. You know, there was no attempt to mount any kind of defence. But he took the rap for, you know, for the crimes of, you know, of both himself and others.
Mm. It was $8.5 million that went missing in the 80s. Huge sum of money today. People do think that Colin Chapman would have been implicated in all of this, and perhaps his reputation would have been quite different had he not died in December 82. We have to say, though, again, that DeLorean was acquitted of all charges.
Was he acquitted, or was he just not, or were they unable to charge him because they couldn't get him to the UK?
I don't know. What I read is that he was acquitted of all charges, but perhaps that's a technicality. Perhaps it's the same thing. I
thought he couldn't be extradited, so charges were never brought, but I might be wrong.
So he was never found
guilty.
But
either way, he certainly wasn't convicted of anything.
Yeah. So he's... That's the story of John DeLorean, isn't it? A stellar early career as a car engineer and executive. Goes off to create his own sports car company, something that he envisaged being a very innovative, pioneering sports car. Turns out it's not that simple. The economy tanks. He builds a factory in Northern Ireland. The car turns out nothing like he wanted it to. And he becomes so desperate that he's involved in drug trafficking and fraud. Yeah, it's just a hell of a fall from grace in not a particularly great period of time. He lived away the rest of his life in a very small condo, having lived for several decades in the lap of luxury in enormous houses.
Yeah, Concorde everywhere.
That was the
other thing. And I think that's what really cheesed off the government, was that he had been living high on the hog when his company was going under. You know, it was always the most expensive hotels. It was always Concorde. And this, frankly, was British taxpayers' money that he was spending. Are you going to ask me if I've ever driven one?
Yes, I am going to. I should just to sort of wind up on John DeLorean himself. So he died March 19th, 2005. And according to his family and people who knew him, till the very end, he was talking to backers, investors, other people about his next car project. So right to the end, he was trying to get something else off the ground. We have to talk about, you visited the DeLorean factory just outside Belfast. You've driven a DeLorean. So can we talk about the factory first?
Well, we can. I visited the factory. I couldn't get into it. Because it was all barriered up. It was a state-of-the-art factory when it was built in the very early 1980s. It struck me as being very large. I think they only produced 9,000 cars in that couple of years. I think it was designed for a capacity of producing about 15,000 cars a year. And I know that they had to produce a five-figure sum per year to be profitable. And they didn't do that in total, let alone per year. The test track, I don't even know if it's still there. I expect it is.
I think it is.
Even then, there were, you know, it was totally overgrown. It wasn't safe to drive around. You could walk it, but it had a bank section. And it was just, I can just remember going there. It was a... it wasn't a nice day. It was dark and it was rainy, and just kind of wandering around, looking at this test track and looking at the factory, and you know, thinking of the hopes and the dreams of, you know, when this place was all sparkling new, and just how much hope people would have had for their futures there. All of which came to nothing, and I found it profoundly sad. And then I drove the car. It wasn't all bad. I mean, it was a terrible car, but for lots of the reasons that we have discussed. But actually, you could see, or I could see, it could have had something. If it had had a bit more power, if it had had a bit less weight, if they built it properly. I mean, I can remember, for instance, that it rode and handled really well. It's called double wishbone front suspension, multi-link rear axle. You know, back in the day where Porsches were still using semi-trailing arms on McPherson struts. It had potential, totally unrealised. There was some talk, wasn't there, about doing a twin turbo engine for it. I mean, you know, that engine did go on to produce, you know, decent horsepower in, you know, Alpines and that sort of thing, with turbochargers attached. And, you know, what if? But, you know, the car, even once Chapman had to completely re-engineer it, the car had the potential to be okay. I'm not sure it would ever have really troubled the 911. But when I drove it, it was just so slow. And I can remember the gear change was terrible and the engine was arthritic. And you just sat there thinking, really? This is really what they thought was the standard? And it's astonishing, really, because it was... The sadness is it wasn't just a bad car. It was a bad car that you could see how it could have been at least decent. But it never got anywhere near it. So I was quite happy to hand it back and try not to think about it again. And of course, once all the Back to the Future nonsense happened, the company was shut, it was all over. You know, that was an entirely retrospective thing. So that, arrived far too late. And, I wonder now, if it hadn't been for those films, if anybody would remember DeLorean. I mean, I read somewhere that, like, of the 9,000-odd cars they built, like, 6,500 are still on the road. But I think, frankly, we should thank Marty McFly more than John DeLorean for that. Because without that legacy, I think it would be a completely forgotten thing. I don't think that we'd be having this conversation with people going, oh, yeah, there was something called a DeLorean, wasn't there? But as it is, it's kind of front and centre in our minds. But that had nothing to do with DeLorean or the factory or the car.
And I suppose for John DeLorean's legacy, the Back to the Future films mean that he's perhaps more closely associated with the car that's the time machine from the movies than with being implicated in fraud and drug trafficking trials. It's a great story, isn't it? And it's odd that there hasn't been a proper blockbuster biopic, a Hollywood film of his life, because it's just the stuff of a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think it's sad when anybody dies disgraced with their dreams in tatters, but, he absolutely brought it on himself. He was absolutely the architect of his own downfall. He unquestionably... I have to be careful, don't I? Well, do I? There was all sorts of things he should have been called to answer, which he never did. I do not buy into the concept of the victimless crime in this context. Really, really interesting guy. But I think for all he achieved in the early part of his career, that's not what he'd mean. People don't remember John DeLorean as the person who built the Pontiac GTO or turned around Chevrolet or for the, for the genuinely superb engineer that he was. They just think, well, he's the dodgy bloke who did DeLorean, and that's it. And that's his legacy. And that's, that is sad, but it's probably what he deserves.
Yeah, a career of two halves, really. Good. Okay, well, that's John DeLorean. a brilliant candidate for a podcast like this. So if you've got other suggestions, this actually came in from a reader or a listener, I think. So forgive me, I didn't make a note of your name. But if it was you that suggested we talk about John DeLorean, thank you very much. And yeah, if anyone else has a good idea for a candidate for this sort of podcast, let us know and we'll do it. Good. Okay, well, thank you everybody for listening. Rate and review the podcast as ever. That does mean a lot. It is important. And go and download the Intercooler app as well and start your free trial. Andrew, we'll be back to talk to everybody again next week.
Look forward to it. All the best.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.